everyone, and welcome to this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. This is the Wednesday, November 16th edition. It is brought to you here on the morning of Thursday, November 17th. Hope you're having a great start to your day. Hope it's going well. Hope you're careful out and about with those snowy conditions and slick roads. Taking a look at some of the headlines before we get into a check of our forecast. Cheer Fund is ready for donations. Christmas Fund, started in 1927, aims to brighten the holiday. That is a story by the Globe Gazette staff. Also, the main headline story and photo. The photo shows Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel presenting a key to the city to Mayor Bashkim Romasaj of the municipality of Deakon, Kosovo. Yes, Kosovo. All right, more on that story. Headline, Mason City Potential Sister City Connect. A delegation from Kosovo interested in starting a partnership. Well, that's a story by Mary Loden. We'll find out more here in just a little bit. And then CCHS project scope approved. The Charles City High School renovation plans coming together. A story by Abby Koch. So those stories and more on this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette. This is Andrew Haupt filling in, your reader for this episode. But before we get into the headline news, we're going to get into the headline weather for today and the next few days here. Taking a check of our forecast for Mason City, Clear Lake, and the North Iowa area. Well, for today, Thursday, you can expect a chance of snow and blustery conditions, a chance of flurries before 7 a.m., then a chance of snow mainly today between 7 and 5 p.m., so that's right now. Cloudy conditions, a high near 27 degrees, those wind chill values as low as 5 above. Blustery with a west-northwest wind, gusting as high as 28 miles per hour, a 30% chance of precipitation. New snow accumulation of less than a half inch possible. But again, for today, your Thursday, a high near 27 degrees. For tonight, expect mostly cloudy conditions, those wind chill values as low as negative 5, with an actual temperature low of around 10 degrees above. Blustery conditions with those winds from the west and northwest, gusting as high as 25 miles per hour, but again, though, a low of around 10 degrees above. Wind chill values as low as negative 5 degrees for your overnight tonight into tomorrow, Friday, where you can expect mostly cloudy conditions. Those winds from the northwest gusting as high as 22 miles per hour, an actual high near 17 degrees for your Friday. Very cold out there. Bundle up if you are going out and about, and be careful out on those roads and walkways because it very well may be slick. For tomorrow, actually, no. We did Friday. Let's do Friday night. Mostly cloudy, a low around 8 degrees above. And then for your Saturday, partly sunny skies, a high near 16 degrees and blustery conditions. For Sunday, warming back up a little bit to 27 degrees or so and sunny conditions for your Sunday. Looking at a high of 28 degrees this coming Monday and then back up to 33 degrees on Tuesday. Hopefully melt off some of that snow a little bit as we get that Thanksgiving week started. But again, for today, your Thursday, expect a chance of flurries before 7 a.m. That time's passed already if you're listening to this on the air. And then a chance of snow mainly between 7 and 5 o'clock tonight. Cloudy conditions, a high near 27 degrees. As we're getting this reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette going here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Well, that headline story, Mason City Potential Sister City Connect. We're talking about Kosovo. Yes, Kosovo. Delegation from that country interested in starting a partnership. That's written by Mary Loden. Another photo here does show Mason City 3rd Ward Councilman Joshua Masson shaking hands with Mayor Bashkim Romasaj, municipality of Deakon, Kosovo. Masson was instrumental in Mason City's intent to establish a sister city relationship. The story begins. A small delegation from Kosovo visited Mason City on Tuesday with an interest in establishing a sister city partnership between Mason City and Deakon, spelled D-E-C-A-N, Kosovo, and you know how that's spelled, a municipality of 40,000 people in the eastern part of the country. Mason City Councilman Joshua Masson gave municipality guests a guided tour of the city. Masson attended an open house at the Mason City National Guard Armory earlier this year, where he met Rachel Fales. Fales, who has been to Kosovo several times, told Masson about her wish for Mason City to be a sister city. Since I had the unique connection of being former military and on the city council, I took it upon myself to start this program, Masson said. It wasn't long before Todd Jacobus, Kosovo Committee Chair for Iowa Sister States, contacted him. After looking at comparable criteria, the Iowa Sister States program matched Mason City with Decan, that spelled D-E-C-A-N. We then had signed a letter of intent that we were interested in exploring the match. This was necessary to allow the mayor, that would be Remosage, to visit our city through this program. He is here to meet our town and to introduce his city to us as the next step in the process, Masson said. Jacobus indicated that to Masson in July, he traveled to Kosovo as part of a 38-person delegation consisting of educators, business leaders, government officials, and agriculture officials. Jacobus explained that Masson provided to the Globe Gazette, stating that Iowa has had a sister state partnership with Kosovo since 2013. The partnership began in 2011 as a security cooperation connection between the Kosovo Security Forces and the Iowa Army National Guard through the Department of Defense State Partnership Program, and expanded in 2013 to a whole of Iowa with whole of Kosovo approach, which has been working to connect Iowans and Kosovars across all sectors of society. There are currently 7 sister city partnerships between Iowa and Kosovo, and a few more in the process. Over the last decade, these partnerships have included virtually all sectors of society, such as schools, technology, arts, sports, and law enforcement. The partnership between Iowa and Kosovo has been so prevalent that the Kosovo Ministry of Foreign Affairs established a consulate in Des Moines in January 2016. In addition, the Department of Defense has identified the partnership between Iowa and Kosovo as a model for their state partnership program, Jacobus said. When Mayor Schickel asked Mayor Remosage what they would like to gain from the sister city partnership, Remosage replied, "A sector that I am more focused on lately, it's the sector of tourism. Because of the mountains that we have, it's a very big tourist attraction," he said. Well, Mayor Remosage also said they are very interested in providing better opportunities for their young people. He is very proud of the fact that the entire municipality of Decan was rebuilt from the ashes of their war for independence from Yugoslavia in 1998. He is now responsible for 22 schools as well as hospitals and healthcare facilities. "We will encourage especially youth exchange. Both high school students on both parts, yes," said Artan Duraku, chief of mission for the Kosovo consulate in Des Moines. "I mean, you should know that with potential sister city, you will have a second home in Europe. And for a lot of Iowa kids who are used to flat land in reference to their mountainous region, sometimes it is life-changing." Well, Mason City Mayor Bill Schickel, who presented a key to the city to Mayor Remosage, was enthusiastic about the visit. "It was an honor to host Mayor Remosage and the delegation from Decan, Kosovo. There are a lot of similarities between Iowa and Kosovo, and Decan and Mason City. Both have an emphasis on agriculture, food production, the arts, and tourism. We had lunch at Pasta Bella, which is operated by a family from Kosovo. They also had a chance to spend time at Mason City High School," Schickel said. "Well, Kosovo is an emerging democracy in Europe, and the delegation was very interested to learn about our local government, community, and our economic development success. There is much we are learning from them as well." Well, that written by Mary Loden, who covers city and county government for the Globe Gazette. You can reach her by emailing Mary, M-A-R-Y, dot Loden, L-O-D-E-N, at globegazette.com. All right, that'll be interesting to see what happens with Kosovo. Moving on now. Cheer Fund is ready for donations. Christmas Fund, started in 1927, aims to brighten holiday. That's written by Globe Gazette staff. The story begins. For 95 years, the Globe Gazette Christmas Cheer Fund has helped North Iowans in need have a brighter holiday. The Christmas Cheer Fund was established by Globe Gazette publisher Lee Loomis in 1927, so every child could have a present on Christmas morning. In the years since, it has come to mean a little help at Christmas time to people of all ages. Over the years, the Christmas Cheer Fund has received thousands of letters from children and adults in North Iowa asking for a little help to brighten the holidays. The requests are often not for gifts, but for help with necessities like food, warm socks, or a coat. Other letters are from North Iowa residents who, in their generosity, give the donations that help so many. No donation is too small, from the pennies gathered by kindergartners to the generous checks given in memory of loved ones. In the past 95 years, you have given more than $3.5 million to help fellow North Iowans in need of a little cheer for the holidays. This year's goal is $100,000. Applications will be accepted online only through Friday, December 16th. You can go to go.globegazette.com/cheerfund, C-H-E-E-R-F-U-N-D, to submit in applications, and donations can be mailed to Christmas Cheer Fund, P.O. Box 271, Mason City, Iowa, 504-02-0271, or drop off a donation at the Globe Gazette office at 687 South Taft Avenue, Suite 2 in Mason City, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. That's the Christmas Cheer Fund. All right, final front page story. CCHS, that'd be Charles City High School Project Scope Approved. Charles City High renovation plans coming together. This story by Abby Koch. The big pieces are coming together to breathe new life into Charles City High School. In a 4-to-1 vote, the Charles City School Board approved the scope of the project to renovate the high school. Approval sets the parameters of the project, like what spaces are included and its estimated cost. This is far above a Band-Aid, said Superintendent Ann Lundquist. In May, the community received information from Envision Architecture, based in Waterloo, and Estes Construction, which has locations throughout Iowa, about three different options to upgrade or replace the high school. Those options had estimated costs ranging from a low end of $13 million up to nearly $38 million. The district asked the community to express its preferences in a survey administered by Milwaukee-based Donovan Group in early September. A total of 615 people completed the survey, and the results can be found on the district website. One thing that we heard loud and clear is that there's definitely a perceived need that some things needs to happen, said Envision architect Brad Leeper on Monday night. The plan the district is looking at calls for revitalizing the high school space to be a more secure and current facility. Charles City is also looking to add a fine arts space, mainly an 800-seat auditorium, for instructional activities. The Charles City School District can bond for a maximum of $27 million. Much of the discussion at the October 25th meeting was centered on trimming the cost of the proposal. When you go to levy a bond, which would be a debt service levy, we can do one of two questions. Right now, we're propositioning a $2.70 question. That says Director of Finances Evan Martin, who explained in previous reporting. Based off the current property assessed value in Charles City and $2.70 per $1,000 of assessed value brings us to the bond limit of $27 million. Well, adjustments have been made since the October meeting, where the school board decided in a 4-to-1 vote to move forward with the bond referendum process. The high end of the project lands just above $27 million and a low end of $24 million. Lundquist said the project cannot exceed the high end. Leeper gave the school board an update on where the project was at Monday night. We've come back with a kind of modified plan, which we're calling the revitalized plan. And number one, we heard it loud and clear. It's value, 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 said Leeper. Well, the current plan was displayed to the school board and those in attendance. Leeper walked through the floor plan, adding that adjustments can still be made and much of the existing building is a solid structure to work with. We've been challenged to look at this and have no more than $17 a month cost for the average household in Charles City to make these changes. It's really efficient way to do it. That's a mistake there. It should say really a efficient way to do it, but we find these all the time. The quote continues, and we're accomplishing a lot with that, said Leeper. The auditorium and a new secured entrance are combined, filtering through the existing office. The new auditorium will be in the same space as the existing one because of the relation to the existing performing arts, quote-unquote, circle, as it's called, the performing arts circle. All that works with the new lobby for the auditorium and also doubles as a secure entrance for people coming in, said Leeper. Well, part of crafting the plan was finding a way to rethink the circle structures of the high school. Leeper said they would take out the inner wall, which is non-structural, and leave the columns in place. This will create connections between the classrooms and the resource areas. Some spaces, like the kitchen, will be expanded and others relocated, like the family consumer science space. There are still minor corrections to be made to the plan. This is master planning, and we have a lot of work to do. If we decide as a community this is important, then we've got a lot of work to do working with staff, Leeper said. Now we will make small adjustments as if we were building a house. Of course, those all fall within the scope of the parameters, and then that allows us that freedom to respond to the needs of our constituents, said Lundquist. School Board Director David Schrott was the no vote on moving forward with the process. The next step will be working on the petition language. Again, that written by Abby Koch. All right, that's our final front page story. Moving on now to page A2, Mason City man sentenced for drug and eluding charges. This is written by Matthew Rezab of the Globe Gazette. A Mason City man was sentenced to 5 years in prison after pleading guilty to possession of methamphetamine, eluding, and interference with official acts. According to court records, 32-year-old Harold Victory Stinnett Jr. will serve concurrent sentences. The charges stem from a June 30th incident in which Stinnett led Iowa State Patrol troopers on a chase exceeding the speed limit by more than 25 miles an hour. The affidavit states the pursuit occurred at 2:30 p.m. on East State Street. Stinnett eventually drove his Pontiac Bonneville off the road, leaving it disabled. He then fled on foot before being found hiding underneath a back deck of a residence. Stinnett had $1,645 in cash on his person, and a cell phone and baggie of methamphetamine were found nearby. Stinnett is classified as a habitual felony offender. He was previously convicted of second-degree burglary, third-degree burglary, and two controlled substance violations. We have a photo essay here on page A3 where we move to next, and it is entitled Winter in North Iowa. And it shows some beautiful photos here. Maple leaves, they're still brownish orange, covered in ice and snow in Mason City's East Park. There's a photo here that shows Big Black near Lester Milligan Park in Mason City. I'm guessing that's the name of the stream that's photographed here. It's not completely frozen yet, but it's getting ready to get iced over just soon enough. And there's still some orangish brown leaves on the trees as they are getting ready to go mostly bare and dormant for the winter. And that's a photo by Lisa Gruet. Very beautiful photo. I think that one deserves an award. All kinds of color in that thing. Well, I should say that again. There's kind of a grayish white along with a black and shades shown in the reflection on the stream and then the tree colors itself. And a lot of color, if you ask me, if you're actually looking at it here. But it's a very beautiful photo. Wonderful job, Lisa. Next up shows a pine tree at Arthur J. Girk Arboretum in Georgia Hanford Park in Mason City. That's another good-looking photo. Here's one of a picture of a deer eating some lunch inside its enclosure at East Park in Mason City. And it looks like there's snow all around. This looks like a photo was taken while it was snowing, and you can kind of see this deer amongst the weeds. Almost it looks like a painting. Another photo here is of the Arthur J. Girk Arboretum in Georgia Hanford Park. Maybe that's a spelling error, but it looks to be a big lake there, and you can see the barren trees on the shore. It's a very beautiful photo. And a couple more photos here. Big Blue and Lester Milligan Park in Mason City. Maybe that's the name of that waterway. I guess it looked like a lake to me, it looked like a stream to me, but I'm seeing it's a part of a lake as well. And then South Footbridge in Mason City's East Park is the final photo. It shows snow on the sides of the footbridge, but it's mostly been cleared off. And in the distance, Up ahead, you can see some stairs. Now, some very beautiful photos here on page A3 of the Globe Gazette. If you have time to check it out, I would encourage you to do so. Moving on now to page A4, more news. Victims of parade crash speak at sentencing. This is written by Amy Forlitti and Todd Richmond of the Associated Press. Dozens of people who were hurt or saw their loved ones killed or injured when a man drove his SUV through a Christmas parade in suburban Milwaukee spoke Tuesday about the sheer terror of the crash, as well as the physical and mental anguish that followed, as they delivered raw, tearful statements during the man's sentencing hearing. Darryl Brooks Jr. drove his red Ford Escape through the parade in downtown Waukesha on November 21, 2021. Six people were killed, including an 8-year-old boy. Scores of others were injured. A jury convicted Brooks last month of 76 charges, including 6 counts of first-degree intentional homicide and 61 counts of reckless endangerment. "I feel gutted and broken. It hurts to breathe sometimes," said Sherry Sparks, the mother of Jackson Sparks, the 8-year-old who was killed. "My mama's soul aches for him. This man not only took Jackson away from our family, he violently ripped Jackson from our lives." One by one, Sparks and others told of how they had been affected by the horrors of the crash. They talked about having nightmares and reliving the screams of mothers searching for their children. They described painful injuries, surgeries, and physical therapy. More than one parent said Brooks ran over children like speed bumps. Multiple people said he was pure evil, though some said they forgave him. Sasha Catalan, who was 17 and playing her clarinet in the parade with the Waukesha South Marching Band, said in a soft, wavering voice that she wonders if it would have been better if she had died in someone else's place. Another 17-year-old band member said in a written statement, which was read in court, that their sousaphone saved their life when they were dragged by Brooks' SUV, but the depression that followed left them unable to graduate with classmates. Nearly all of those who spoke Tuesday morning asked Judge Jennifer Darrow to give Brooks the maximum penalty when she sentences him on Wednesday. That would have been yesterday. Donald Teagues, the father of an injured teenager, said in a written statement that was read in court, "It's too bad the state doesn't have the death penalty because you would be put to the front of the line. I hope you rot in hell." Brooks nodded as those comments were read and patted his chest with his palm. Brooks, age 40, almost certainly will spend the rest of his life in prison, and since each homicide count carries a mandatory life sentence. Legal experts said they expect Darrow to make the life sentences consecutive with no chance of parole. The crash left deep scars across southeastern Wisconsin that still haven't healed. Several witnesses wept on the stand during Brooks' trial as they described how the SUV barreled through the crowd, sending bodies flying through the air. Someone in the gallery yelled, "Burn in hell," as Darrow read the guilty verdicts last month. Brooks chose to represent himself during his trial despite overwhelming evidence against him. His interactions with victim witnesses were tense, but he generally treated them respectfully and they kept their answers short. Tuesday was the victim's first chance to confront Brooks while he was forced to sit and listen. Brooks was handcuffed as he sat at the defense table Tuesday, wearing an orange t-shirt and a face mask. He rolled his eyes during some of the victim's statements and at times closed his eyes, shook his head, or bowed his head with his hands clasped in front of him. At one point, he paged through a book. Sparks talked about how her boys were marching in the parade with the baseball team, the Waukesha Blazers. They had decorated a truck filled some balloons, and she went to go sit and watch. "I had no idea then the nightmare that was coming my way," she said, "nor did I know that it would be the last time I would hear Jackson's voice and see his smile." After the SUV plowed through the crowd, she ran toward her boys. She saw Jackson in the arms of a police officer who was running to get him medical attention. Her husband told her that their older son, Tucker, was also hurt. She found Tucker, age 12, under a blanket, first identifying him by his shoes that were sticking out. Both boys had traumatic head and brain injuries and were in the Children's Hospital ICU. The next day, Tucker asked about Jackson. Sparks told the judge it was gut-wrenching to have to tell Tucker that his little brother was not going to make it. Tucker blamed himself. He felt he should have tried to grab Jackson or done more to protect his little brother, she said. All right, moving on now to page A5, school board parental rights push falters. This is an AP story written by Colin Binkley. Now, this is an AP story, so just hold on before you make any rash statements or ideas here, because keep in mind where it's coming from. Protesters gather outside for the Moms of Liberty National Summit is the photo. The thing that's photographed here, it's a picture by Lauren Witte, W-I-T-T-E, of the Tampa Bay Times, and shown via the AP. The sign reads, "Teachers do not indoctrinate our students!" Exclamation point. Teachers do not indoctrinate our students. Do not underline. Republican groups that sought to get hundreds of parents' rights activists elected to local school boards largely fell short on Election Day. Conservative groups that sought to – this is the story beginning now, Dateline Washington. Conservative groups that sought to get hundreds of parents' rights activists elected to local school boards largely fell short in last week's midterm elections, notching notable wins in some Republican strongholds but failing to gain a groundswell of support among moderate voters. Traditionally, nonpartisan local school boards have become fiercely political amid entrenched battles over the teaching of race, history, and sexuality. Candidates opposing what they see as woke ideology in public schools have sought to gain control of school boards across the U.S. and overturn policies deemed too liberal. The push was boosted by Republican groups, including the 1776 Project PAC, which steered millions of dollars into local school races this year amid predictions of a red wave. But on Tuesday, just a third of its roughly 50 candidates won. Moms for Liberty, another conservative political group, endorsed more than 250 candidates, with about half winning so far. And despite resounding victories for Republicans, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, several gubernatorial candidates who leaned heavily on parents' rights fell short, including in Michigan, Wisconsin, Kansas, and Maine. The results raised doubts about the movement's widespread political strength and pose a potential obstacle for Republican lawmakers hoping to rally behind proposed legislation on the issue. With the GOP poised to take a narrow majority in the U.S. House, Leader Kevin McCarthy has already issued plans for a parents' bill of rights, though its details are vague. Teachers' unions and liberal grassroots groups also have been pushing back with money and messaging of their own, casting conservative activists as fearmongers intent on turning parents against public schools. The parents' rights movement demands transparency around teaching but also includes a wide range of cultural stances, calling for schools to remove certain books dealing with race or sexuality, for example, and to end history lessons that aren't patriotic. Quote unquote, as they say here, or right here. In hindsight, activists, this election should have had a stronger emphasis on academic issues. That says Ryan Gurdusky, founder of the 1776 Project PAC, Political Action Committee. The messaging needs to be more positive, he said. Sometimes you lose moderate voters because you're too hyperbolic and you're not speaking truth to something very local to them. The midterms marked a reversal from previous elections that saw parents' rights proponents land major victories. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, hammered the importance of parental rights in his successful campaign last year, winning crucial support from suburban voters 1 year after the state voted for Democrat Joe Biden. Before November 8th, the 1776 PAC had won roughly 75% of its races in the two previous years, putting dozens of school boards across the nation in control of conservative candidates. Those victories were attributed largely to parents' anger over schools' handling of the pandemic, including long closures and mask mandates. This year, the message pivoted to the cultural divides that have sparked battles around transgender rights, racism, and sexuality. In New Buffalo, Michigan, in the state's purple southwest corner, four candidates supported by the 1776 PAC took on four candidates favored by a teachers' union. The conservatives took out full-page ads in two local newspapers, accusing their opponents of supporting a school program that promotes critical race theory, sexually inappropriate material, and anti-parent content. "No critical race theory," the ad read. "No biological boys and girls sports." Later, local residents began to raise worries about the Furries, or Furries, F-U-R-R-I-E-S, a myth spread by some conservatives alleging that students at some U.S. schools have been allowed to use litter boxes and given other special treatment if they identify as animals. The level of misinformation was startling to Denise Churchill, one of the candidates endorsed by the teachers' union. But on Tuesday, she and her three running mates won by wide margins, with the city also voting for Democrats at the state level. "Truth prevails and hate loses," said Churchill, who has two children in the district. She said the district has always invited parent involvement. But parental rights does not mean that you get to cherry-pick what's taught in the schools. The county that houses New Buffalo was a prize target for the 1776 group, having voted for Republican candidates for president and governor in recent elections. The group campaigned for 20 candidates across 8 districts, but just 4 were elected. Many were defeated by union-backed candidates. The group's biggest victory was in the right-leaning Carroll County, Maryland, where its candidates won 3 seats. All 4 of its candidates won in Florida, which has become a stronghold for the movement. All right, we're past that halfway mark with that all being read and said. Move on now to the obituaries and tell you that you're listening to this reading of the Mesa City Globe Gazette here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We're so glad to have you with us. All material heard here on IRIS is intended solely for the use of our audience. I'm your reader today. My name is Andrew Haupt, filling in here. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, then you can give us a call at the office at 515-243-6833 or toll-free from across the state, 1-877-404-4747. And now we start with today's obituaries, which it looks to be just one full obituary plus 2 death notices. So we begin with the obituary of Robert Bob Falk, our only full obituary for today. Of Rudd, R-U-D-D, Rudd, Iowa. Robert Bob Falk, F-U-L-K, age 69 of Rudd, Iowa, passed unexpectedly on Sunday, November 13th, 2022. A funeral service will be held at 3 p.m. Friday, November 18th, 2022, at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, located at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, with Mark Doble officiating. Burial will be held in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City, where he will be laid to rest next to his father and brother. A visitation will be prior to the service on Friday, November 18th, 2022, from 2 to 3 p.m. at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. Memorials can be directed to Agar Ability, or A-G-R Ability, A-B-I-L-I-T-Y, at the address of 401 Northeast 66th Avenue in Des Moines, Iowa 50313, with the attention to T. Kenninger. Kenninger spelled K-E-N-I-N-G-E-R. Agar Ability is the USDA's organization that assists farmers with disabilities so they can continue in their farming operation. Bob was born August 21st, 1954. And raised on a farm east of Rudd, Iowa, the son of Walter Wally and Joyce, maiden name McKee, Falk. He was a graduate of Rockford High School. He met and married Gloria Slawson, that name spelled S-L-A-W-S-O-N, and from this union, their daughter Jennifer was born. The couple later divorced. Bob spent his young adult life living in numerous places such as California, Wyoming, and Colorado. During those years, he worked many different jobs, being a heavy equipment operator during road construction in the mountains required skill and a bit of moxie. Bob excelled at this occupation. Given the opportunity by his stepfather, Al Toppin, Bob returned to Iowa to begin his passion for farming. Bob truly took pride in being a farmer, always managing his equipment and crops with his best effort. Horses had a soft spot in Bob's heart. At one point, he owned 13. In his free time, he enjoyed riding his 350 Honda motorcycle around, as well as being the best tomato grower in the Falk family. It was said that Bob was a deal hunter. Every Sunday, he spent finding the best bargain for groceries. Bob experienced a lot at a young age and persevered through the difficult times. He took great care of his mother, being there for anything she needed. Bob will be remembered as a soft-spoken man with a quick smile who gave unconditionally to those who he loved. Those left to cherish memories of Bob are his daughter Jennifer Folk, grandson Kevin Vincent, mother Joyce Toppin, brothers Dennis Folk and James Folk, James married to Sean, stepson Jeremy Slauson, nephew Rob Folk, married to Jordan, nieces Elena, Eva, and Hazel Folk, as well as numerous extended family members and friends. Bob is preceded in death by his father Walter, brother Billy, stepfather Elvin Toppin, and grandparents. The Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, located at 126 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, is a charge of arrangements. They can be reached at 641-423-2372 and also at colonialchapels.com. From there, we go on to our two death notices. The first for Florence E. Ringham, age 84, of Mason City, who died Tuesday, November 15th. That would have been 2 days ago. 2022 at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice Inpatient Unit. Arrangements are with the Major Erickson Funeral Home. Next up, we go to Joan V. Brooks Schroeder, age 93, of Clarion, who died Saturday, November 12th at the Clarion Wellness and Rehab. Arrangements are with the Ewing Funeral Home of Clarion. And that takes care of our obituaries and death notices. Move on now to the world of sports here in the Mason City Globe-Gazette. We're talking about Iowa State football. That's our first story here. Cyclones preparing for a unique Texas Tech offense. It's written by Rob Gray and is special to the Globe-Gazette. Dateline Ames, Iowa. Well, Texas Tech has started three different quarterbacks. The Red Raiders' top playmaker on defense, Tyree Wilson, is injured and likely won't play against Iowa State at 6 p.m. Saturday at Jack Trice Stadium. So when it comes to facing adversity, whether incidental or self-manufactured, Texas Tech, with a 5-5 record and 3-4 in the Big 12, finds itself in a similar space with the Cyclones, hobbled and hungry. The one positive for them is all those quarterbacks other than the freshmen have played a ton of football. That says ISU head coach Matt Campbell, whose team is 4-6 overall and 1-6 in conference play. They certainly have a unique system. Their system is set up for balance. They set up for how many snaps can you get? How can you do all those things? Yet at the end of the day, the credit has to go to their coaching staff. To weather some of that, you have to have a system that allows that consistency maybe to show up in the quarterback position. That's the end of that quote. It's possible that former Oregon transfer Tyler Shough, that name spelled S-H-O-U-G-H, will be tabbed for a second straight start after leading the Red Raiders to a 43-28 win last Saturday over Kansas. Shough has battled injuries throughout his career, but led the Red Raiders in rushing with 76 yards, including a 9-yard touchdown run. Texas Tech has rushed for 20 touchdowns while throwing for 22. So the balance Campbell spoke of is apparent both on the stat sheet and during game play. I definitely expect them to move as fast as possible, said Cyclone senior linebacker Orion Vance. So far for us, as our defense has done all season, we'll continue to try to stop the run and just get off the field. ISU's defense has excelled in that area all season. The Cyclones rank 9th nationally in opponents' third down conversion percentage at 29.01% and 12th in rushing defense at 105.2 yards per game. But ISU's offense has been the polar opposite. The Cyclones turned the ball over season-high 5 times in last Saturday's 20-14 loss at Oklahoma State and fell to 1-5 this season in one-score games. Obviously, we do have to be outcome aware, and the outcome, that's on me, Campbell said. That's on the head football coach. For whatever reason, we're kind of sputtering in that inconsistency and why I haven't been able to fully get us out of there yet. Yeah, it's frustrating. Those are things where I have to be better. I've got to find out where that gap is and continue to do everything within our power to plug away. Well, ISU needs to go 2-0 to in its remaining regular season games against the Red Raiders and fourth-ranked TCU to ensure a 6th consecutive bowl berth. It's possible one win could lead to postseason play as well, but that's not guaranteed and dependent on multiple factors outside the Cyclones' control. So the hunger to win has morphed into desperation as senior night swings into view. I'm just trying to cherish everything and keep my emotions intact the whole week, senior safety Anthony Johnson said. And that ends that story. Moving on now to Iowa football. Same challenge, different week is the headline. And the photo shown is that of Iowa linebacker Seth Benson sacking South Dakota State quarterback Jason Freeman during the third quarter of the Hawkeyes' 73 win on September 3rd at Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City, if you all remember that game. The Hawkeyes face another talented running back in Gophers Ibrahim. This is written by Steve Batterson of the Quad City Times, Dateline, Iowa City. A new week presents a familiar challenge for the Iowa defense. The Hawkeyes will be facing one of college football's elite running backs again. Minnesota's Muhammad Ibrahim is the third back who rates among the top five nationally Iowa has lined up against this season. The Hawkeyes held the nation's rushing leader, Illinois' Chase Brown, to within 2 yards of his current average of 144.2 yards per game 1 week after the fourth leading rusher in college football, Blake Corum of Michigan, was held to within 2 yards of his average of 134.9 yards per game. Ibrahim enters Saturday's 3 p.m. game at Huntington Bank Field, averaging 140.1 yards per game, topping 1,000 yards in a season for the third time in his career during the Golden Gophers' 31-3 win over Northwestern last weekend. He carried 36 times on his way to a 178-yard performance against the Wildcats, helping Minnesota do what Minnesota does. Our style of football is to run the ball. Time management is what we pride ourselves on, Ibrahim said. We got up, and we understood that we wanted to run the clock. That's what we do best. Well, Ibrahim has helped make that happen while rushing for at least 100 yards in 18 consecutive games, something no running back in the Football Bowl subdivision has accomplished since 2000. Iowa assistant defensive line coach Jay Nyman told his players Monday that Ibrahim, however you say it, is a little like water, that if he sees a crack, he'll flow through it. He runs hard, has great quickness, and cuts fast to the hole, Hawkeye linebacker Seth Benson said. There are a lot of good backs in the Big Ten, and he's up there at the top of the list. With game-time temperatures in the Twin Cities to be in the mid-teens around kickoff, the ball will likely end up Ibrahim's frequently. That's not uncommon in an offense that ranks second in the Big Ten in rushing to Michigan with its average of 220.9 yards per game on the ground and leads the conference with 461 carries this season. We know what they like to do, and we know he'll get the ball a lot. We just have to ready for it, Benson said. That includes sticking with Ibrahim until the play is over. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said the 5'10", 210-pound six-year senior needs to be defended until the whistle blows. He's just tough, hard-nosed, Ferentz said. I don't know if he's like a 4.3 second 40-yard dash guy or anything like that, but he's just a tough football player. Ferentz said he compares to the Wolverines' Corum in a number of ways. When it looks maybe there's nothing there, the next you know, he's got a 5-8 yard gain. If you don't tackle him, get him down, he's not quitting, Ferentz said. Well, Ibrahim has returned to action after missing all but Minnesota's opening game in 2021, suffering a torn anterior cruciate ligament after rushing for 200 yards and 3/4 of the Golden Gophers game against Ohio State. The Baltimore native announced within days that he planned to return for a sixth season. He's a really veteran player. Have a lot of respect for him, Ferentz said. The guy is a winner. And as Ibrahim prepares for his final home game, he has Iowa's attention. You have to be aware of where he is at on every snap, linebacker Jack Campbell said. The Hawkeyes had a similar situation last weekend where it faced the only other running back in the Big Ten besides Brown, Corum, and Ibrahim, who averages more than 100 rushing yards per game. Iowa held Wisconsin's Braylon Allen to 40 yards on 17 carries, well below a season average that dropped from 109.9 yards per game to 102.9 yards after being introduced to the Hawkeye defense. There are so many good backs in the league this year, it seems like we're going up against one every week, Campbell said. Each of them is different in their own way, but the challenge is to not let them get comfortable. Campbell said Iowa accomplished that last week against Allen and the Badgers, and now looks forward to the test Ibrahim and the Golden Gophers provide. It's a new week. We have to go out and try to prove ourselves all over again, Campbell said. Well, Iowa items. Here's a subheadline. Target practice. With frigid temperatures predicted for Saturday's game at Minnesota, Iowa practiced outdoors Tuesday, work that took place on the snowy turfs adjacent to the Hawkeyes' indoor facility and included a little fun, a few snow angels by the receivers, and a few snowballs getting tossed around. The defensive line guys, they got it started, Iowa center Logan Jones said, referencing an impromptu snowball fight started by Joe Evans, Lucas Van Ness, Logan Lee, and Yaya Black. I took one to the stomach from Joe, but I got him back a little later. We had some fun and got in a good practice. Well, Bruce expected back. Receiver and punt returner Arlen Bruce IV participated in practices on Monday and Tuesday and is expected to return to action Saturday at Minnesota. The Hawkeyes' third leading receiver missed last weekend's game against Wisconsin. Starting offensive guard Bo Stevens, injured in the game against the Badgers, is currently doubtful for the game against the Golden Gophers. Nick DeJong, will likely start if Stevens is unavailable. Talks will wait. Most Iowa seniors have an additional year of eligibility available to them because of the COVID-19 situation 2 years ago. Coach Kirk Ferentz said he hasn't talked with players yet about their thoughts on that, something that will take place once the regular season ends. All right, we have a local news story for sports here. Two Osage seniors make All-State team. Talking about prep volleyball, Ashenbrenner earns second straight honor and Francis claims first. It's written by Zach Martin of the Globe Gazette. Claudia Ashenbrenner and Jaden Francis have been stalwarts in Osage's volleyball rotation for the last 4 years. It has been Francis being the catalyst of a back row as the Green Devils' libero. After 3 years of being in the middle, Ashenbrenner went to the outside in her final prep season. Both of them were on the Iowa Girl Coaches Association, or IGCA, All-State teams released on Tuesday. Ashenbrenner was named to the Class 3A second team, and Francis was an honorable mention in 3A. Those two were the only representatives from the North Iowa area. Osage won another top of Iowa East Conference title, swept its way through the regional tournament, and qualified for state for the seventh straight year. The Green Devils fell to eventual state champion Davenport Assumption in 4 sets. Ashenbrenner finished with 334 kills on the season, 11th most in 3A. Her hitting efficiency remained high at .266, one of the better marks amongst outside hitters in the classification. The TIC East Player of the Year was an all-around player this fall, third on the team with 204 digs. She also notched 41 total blocks and fired 36 service aces with a 90.9 serving percentage. Ashenbrenner was third team All-State last year. Francis, bound for Upper Iowa, reached 1,000 career digs this season and set the new career mark for most digs in Osage history. She also served above 90% and had 29 aces. Her season finished with 10 kills. Francis, a TICE's first team honoree, also dished out 57 assists. It is her first career All-State honor. Both Ashenbrenner and Francis were named to the 3A Central All-District team on Monday. Joining those two were Clear Lake's Zada Johnson, or that name Zada spelled X-A-D-A, Johnson, and Forest City's tandem of Jaden Jerome and Jalen Hovenga. In Class 1A, St. Ansgar had a pair on the North Central team in outside hitter Addison Tabbert and setter Aspen Falk. A loaded Class 2A Northeast squad is where Lake Mills' Ellie Hanna was honored. Last story by Zach Martin, and the photo shows Osage's Claudia Ashenbrenner going up to hit the ball during the third set of an IGHSAU, Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union State Volleyball Tournament quarterfinal match November 1st at the Extreme Arena in Coralville. All right, another sports story here, and it's a football story written by Eric Olson of the Associated Press. The headline, Big 12 teams face no cakewalks in final weeks. And the photo shows TCU wide receiver Quentin Johnson celebrating a touchdown against Texas with wide receiver Tay Barber during the second half of last Saturday's game in Austin, Texas. With 2 weeks left in the regular season, six teams remain alive for the second spot in the Big 12 championship game, and others are still trying to become bowl eligible. Based on how the season has played out so far, it's likely many of those final games will be close. The average winning margin in Big 12 games is 13.5 points, lowest among the Power 5 conferences. In 27 of the 35 conference games, the margin at some point in the fourth quarter was one score, or 8 points or less, according to Sport Radar. 15 of those 27 games ended up decided by one score. Well, TCU coach Sonny Dykes points to high-level coaching and recruiting across the board as reasons for the competitiveness. There's just no layups, Dykes said. Some people have the good fortune of being in leagues where the season starts and they go, well, we're going to win. These six games, then these three games are going to be tough. Well, that doesn't happen in the Big 12. Dykes also said teams near or at the bottom of the standings have continued to play hard. Among them is West Virginia, which forced out athletic director Shane Lyons this week largely because of its struggles in a season that began with a one-score non-conference loss to Pittsburgh and has seen an overtime loss to Kansas before last week's win over Oklahoma on a game-ending field goal. We're going to continue to fight and get better and win as many games as possible and do it the right way, like he would want, Coach Neil Brown said. Oklahoma, tied with the Mountaineers for eighth place, has lost its two games by a total of 4 points, which brought home the nature of the season to Coach Brent Venables. It will punish you for mistakes, a lack of technique, bad timing, a lack of precision, he said, but it will reward you when you do things the right way. Well, number four, TCU, with a 10-0 record and 7-0 in the Big 12, has done plenty right. And the numbers state so there. The Horned Frogs beat Texas 17-10 last week to clinch its spot in the December 3rd Big 12 title game in Arlington, Texas. They have prevailed in six conference games that had one-score margins in the fourth quarter and are firmly in the mix for college football playoff. If you're going to get on the kind of run that we're on and you're going to play as many close games as we've played, Dykes said, then you're going to have to figure out different ways to win them. Well, entering this weekend, Kansas State, Oklahoma State, Baylor, Texas, Texas Tech, and Kansas are mathematically alive for the second spot in the championship game. Number 19, Kansas State, with a 7-3 record and 5-2 in the Big 12, has the inside track and would clinch on Saturday if it wins at West Virginia and Texas loses at Kansas. If that scenario does not unfold, the race would be decided the following weekend. K-State is 3-2 in the Big 12 games that had one-score margins in the fourth quarter. Texas is 2-3 in such games. The Big 12 already had six teams that have reached the minimum of six overall wins to be qualified to play in a bowl. Texas Tech and Oklahoma each need one more win to become eligible, and West Virginia and Iowa State would need to win out. Iowa State, with a 4-6 season record and 1-6 in the Big 12, has been the team with the hardest luck in close games. The Cyclones open conference play with four losses by a total of 14 points. All seven of their Big 12 games have had one-score margins in the fourth quarter, and they've lost six. Coach Matt Campbell saluted his players' perseverance through so many losses. 90% of the teams I've been around fold their tent, Campbell said. The next thing you know, you get blown out here, you get blown out there, but this team never has, and it hasn't because our seniors have held the standard, he said. Well, Texas Tech visits Iowa State on Saturday for a cold weather meeting of teams trying to get to bowls. The Red Raiders wouldn't have gotten to the Liberty Bowl last season if it hadn't been for Jonathan Garibay's 62-yard field goal as time expired, beat the Cyclones 41-38. Iowa State attempting to extend its school record bowl streak to six in a row is the perfect illustration of there being no gimmies in the Big 12. The Cyclones are in last place despite leading the conference in all four major defensive categories. This, first-year Texas Tech coach Joey McGuire said, is going to be a tight game. And with all that being read and said, you've been listening to this reading of the Mesa City Globe-Gazette here on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Thank you so much for sharing your time with IRIS. This has been Andrew Haupt, your reader. Hoping that you have a great rest of your morning and day. Be careful outside in the weather. And as always, it's great being with you and great to be hosting this reading of the Mesa City Globe-Gazette. The Wednesday, November 16th edition is brought to you here on the morning of Thursday, November 17th. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you so much for listening, and straight ahead.